Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The VN team.
QNL.
Now we're all thinking about what the different leaders would look like, what they would dress up as if they were a lone shark. I know we're all thinking.
Well, hello and welcome to episode 139. We're here with Dan Q.
With a guaranteed margin of error, you will enjoy this episode 100%.
Makalua.
I think Dan needs some more caffeine so he can check his math. Yep.
Me and team.
I'm a walking civilpedia.
He is.
More like sitting.
Sitting civilpedia?
Sitting civilpedia.
I'm a sitting civilpedia. I could walk while casting, but no.
I can walk about as far as the cord will let me.
Yeah. That seems to be the restriction.
I wanted to go over our first topic in our research lab, which is called Unique Units, Unique Buildings, Why Not a Civ-Specific Tech Advance? So this topic was started by Israelite76, and he's asking in the 2K Games Forum, why not have a specific, well, let's just read this topic. I'm not sure if this has been discussed before, but I think it'd be interesting to have one tech advance that is unique to each civ that they would automatically receive once it's been reached. The advance could be chosen per civ in relation to wonder that is associated with it or is something that is synonymous with that civ. For example, when Egypt reaches the option to reach research masonry, it will then receive it automatically, which will then help it build the pyramid. Alternatively, when the Iroquois is trouting, they would receive that automatically if this is the civ's expertise. Well, this is a pretty interesting idea. Obviously, if we had, like, a civ-specific tech advance, it's not something that could be traded. I'm not sure if we need it, although if something like this were added, I don't think it would be bad.
Yeah, his idea of taking existing techs that are already in there, like trapping or masonry and opening it for certain civs, that's a good one. Because at first I thought he was talking about having a whole new set of unique techs, and as many civs end up in the game, that just bloats the tech tree.
Yeah.
Wait, is he suggesting new unique techs or faster research lines?
I think he's saying, like, get a free tech. Each civ gets a specific tech that when they open it up, they automatically get it without having to research, like, a free tech. They don't get to choose.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And at first I thought he was saying a new unique tech for each one, and I was like, whoa, wait a minute.
It's just a little bit hard to balance, that's all, because with all that, you know, with so many civs, like, I mean, would they all receive techs earlier in the game? You know, I don't really think so.
Stuck with U.S.? When do they get their free tech? Do they get musket?
Do we get the internet?
Play it because they're not going to get their free tech until so far down the street, it's not going to matter.
They could give them something Industrial Revolution. They had a lot of things going on around that time in history.
Or even in a more extreme example, you could say, well, if someone is getting their free tech as their civ, like the United States, and they get it later on in the game, you could do a late game start, which I never do. But then it's kind of, okay, so then they get them. Then what about those civs that had the tech early on, which you would just have already?
Yeah, see, that's another thing. True. Free tech that early on for something like masonry in Egypt, that's huge. Later, free tech later on down the tech tree is not so big, but that's a whole thing they don't have to research. That's a whole other tech that they could get in the same amount of time.
It really depends what it is. Like, if it's something that lets you get to mech infantry on one less great scientist or something, or stealth bombers, then all of a sudden you're looking at a fairly decent boost. I don't have a problem with this as an idea. Like Lisa said, it would be a little bit difficult to balance, but, you know, there's so much in this game that's already pretty darn imbalanced. I actually see this as causing among others. Yes.
I mean, it really depends. I mean, like Phil said, you know, you can get mech infantry. I would think that, you know, some of the more, you know, military-oriented civs would probably get military tech, and that, I mean, that could severely imbalance the game if somebody got, you know, I don't know, Maceman, like, really early because Chinese did civil service or something. Like, that would kind of suck.
Yeah, they get machinery for Choco new early.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then it could just be, like, you know, Roman Civilization 4 kind of scenario.
Yeah, imagine it says in the chat that, you know, Civs already have unique units that are obsolete in late game starts. That's true, and even another reason why this would be a bad idea, because they already have, their unique unit is already obsolete, and their tech everybody already has it as well. It's like, wow. But maybe a more pressing issue is also the fact that with a particular technology, if you're playing on a normal speed, or even, in my case, I prefer the quick speed format, the time that, okay, let's say that you get that unique unit because that you get that technology right away, as soon as you are able to research it, it's ding because it has the unique unit that you have associated with it. Okay, but then there's a limited amount of time, potentially, where that is actually going to be useful to you. Now, sure, you could build that, and then later on you could upgrade it, you know, more cheaply than you would be able to buy it outright or to construct the unit from the beginning, but at the same time, it's one of those things where the window of opportunity is limited, whereas compared to kind of tying into a unique unit as opposed to a unique building, for example, which you could build early on, mid-game, and you could have that advantage from that point on throughout the rest of the game. So it's like a unique unit, except that maybe the technology you get isn't even a unique unit. You get that technology, what is it that is going to allow you to build? And is that actually something that's going to be beneficial to your strategy? I forget who said it in the thread, but I think someone was concerned about that it might pigeonhole Civs a little bit because now the entire focus is speed to get that at the expense of anything and everything else. And because, ooh, you get that free tech and because it's a military technology, whether it's for a unique unit or not, then that's its advantage at the expense of other things. The person who started this thread, Israelite76, said that he thinks that the BODs, quoting directly, that the BODs of 2K games can come up with 24 unique techs from the ones available on the technology tree up to and including the industrial era and distribute them between the Civs in a logical and fair way. So to go back to an earlier point about the interpretation, 24 unique techs.
Is there even 24 techs in any current era?
No, but you wouldn't need them to be. However, you would have to be really careful about doling out instant ironworking, instant horseback riding, things like that.
Instant ironworking for Rome, oh god.
Yeah, there you go. That would be extra balance.
The Mongols have to get horseback riding.
That's what they're famous for.
That's make them work for it. You actually have to go and research that. You don't just go, oh, you could research it, so ding, here you go. You know, I like having ruins on in the game, but do we really need another mechanism for that? Ooh, look at that. I just got a free technology because of who I am.
I would argue this it's is like a better mechanism than ruins because you can plan around it and there's some strategy in it, but that's just me. I hate ruins. And that's a surprise to our long-time listeners, but I hate random chance elements in a strategy game that you don't really control much.
The is 81 says that I missed the Civ 4 starting tech, but this is better in my opinion. I don't think it's better in my opinion, and the Civ 4 starting tech was that
they had two specific
ones. Yeah, they are set for Civ.
Yeah, I think like England was always fishing and mining, maybe.
Alternative starting tech. This might actually be better, just because you know the starting tech. I mean, they didn't really you know go along very well with what the Civ was about in Civilization 4. On that end, like as a replacement for the starting tech mechanic. I guess this would be alright if it were balanced and, I mean, I don't know, I mean, it would help you get through the tech tree faster, I guess, in general. But that's not really the issue with Civ 5, it's the low production rate that's the problem. So, yeah, I don't know, I wouldn't say it's the first thing that you add.
We don't like the random thing going because you can have two players of equal skill. They're going to play the same Civ, but if they'll roll completely different starting techs, one of them's going to have a better game because of what they got. Messes up your barometer of how good someone is. I mean, even the same player playing the same Civ, two or three different games, is going to be completely different. And it's not just start. It's like with the starting position random. I mean, we have to deal with that Civ.
It's bad that the game is different, like in terms of how it plays out. But having such a crucial factor that you really can't apply any strategy to whatsoever, the fact factor so strongly in the gameplay is pretty bad. It really pulls what the strategy element from the turn-based strategy that is the genre of Civilization. Like, you don't really have to think much when you get iron working. You just build swords.
I know he's trying for a unique flavor here, and I think when you're talking about a technology, if you want the unique flavor, then it is what he did say in the follow-up post about a unique tech for an individual Civ. But that's just, as you said, wow. You want a unique flavor. You want it tied to a technology, like unique building and a unique unit, but making the technology in and of itself unique in some fashion is problematic. Given how we progress through the game is very much based on the progression through the technology tree.
Yeah, what are you going to do? Like, the example he had was about giving the U.S. rocketry for the Apollo program. So what, you're going to rename it the Apollo program and it's still rocketry? You know, kind of how we have our buildings that are similar to the unique building, a base type of building that they've just altered something to. So maybe you get something else extra with rocketry that you normally wouldn't get because you're the U.S.
Matt, he doesn't want to be a rocket.
Although rocket.
Well, yeah, I don't want to be a rocket man. I want to be a rocket woman.
You want to be a rocket woman? Well, you already are. Wait, we're talking about something else.
I don't think she wants a rocket inside of, you know, sex change surgery.
Yeah.
But,
whoa.
Oh, wait, should we move on to forum talk?
That might be in the best interest of our listening audience.
Well, shot the gush now.
Okay, on to forum talk. This is the most important Civ attribute. Psycho.
I'm not sure that was accidental, to be honest with you, but continue.
Accidental? No. I apologize. It was initially, yes. Started by Psycho. And he asks, in a standard game for you, which attribute do you think is the most important attribute on which to focus? Pound for pound, I'd say science is by far the most important attribute. It's tied to every victory condition and into every other attribute. Seems like everything in the game is trying to lead you to science, and anyone who gets a large science advantage is destined to have an easy win. But that's just my humble opinion, he says. Now, I gotta preface this. There's a poll on this, which is probably why Dan selected it. And I voted improperly in this poll because I guess I TLDR'd what was actually a short standing. I was not paying attention to what he was actually asking. So I actually voted happiness, and I would have voted science, too, because he's asking which attribute you focus on, and that one is absolutely the one you focus on. So if you see the mean team voting happiness, well, that was a little wonky on my part. Anyway, happiness, I don't know, science does lead the poll at 35.83% of the votes. 43 people voted for that. Next is production with 28, and then gold with 18, happiness with 12. Food with 10, culture with 9. And I kind of do agree with the science thing. You really want to focus on that because there are other ways to come up with, you're selling happiness for gold, which you're then funneling into science. That's what you're doing. So clearly science is the priority when you're signing all these research agreements. You're spending your resources on science. And that gives you the units that you need to go on a raffle stomp later on, or possibly not very much later on. And you can pretty well take advantage of a tech lead to win. You know, it's always been true in Civ. It's not a very difficult thing to do. Once you have a tech lead, you're probably going to win, unless you're just massively too small, which is less an issue with one unit per tile anyway.
And I would even extend that question a little bit more, which is, in a standard game, what attribute do you think is the most important attribute on which to focus overall? Because there are times when you want to be focusing on other things. Perhaps in the early game, you want to focus on gold so you can transfer that into buying military units to go on a raffle stomp, for example. I also understand the inclination, like the number 2 ranking here for production doesn't surprise me because we have talked about how the lacking of production is that then focuses our attention a little bit more on other things such as gold. And we've covered the reasons why for science, and I actually haven't voted in this poll yet, but I commit to doing that at some point in the future with a margin of error up to and including 100%. But what about you, Lisa Mackey? Would you agree that it's science
Yeah, because it drives all the other things, like the happiness and the gold. You can make more happiness, make more gold, if you research the texts that give you the new buildings and stuff.
Okay, Lisa, you agree too, because I was about to speak for all of us, but you hadn't said yet, so I just wanted to make sure. You know, I'm not the kind of guy that would take a woman out on a date and presume to order for her in a restaurant, so I'm not going to presume to know what your vote would be in this poll.
Oh, well, you know, that's as close as you're going to get, so,
Well, wait a minute.
So, of course, you're going to get to dating her, Dan.
No. All right. I'll burn you back. No, you said I wanted to date a woman.
The age of this cast is just gone down by 10 or so. Maybe 15.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying this, I'm afraid.
I like how half of what Lisa said, but oh, God.
coffee's a good thing. I would agree that science is probably the most important attribute for yourself overall. However, yeah, like Dan said, there are occasions in which, you know, I pay a lot more attention to, if I'm going for a culture victory, then you better know that, you know, that's probably the most important thing I'm going after. For me, food would probably be the second most important thing, just because, that's been a problem for me before. And also just ensuring that, you know, each city is growing when it needs to be and sometimes starving when I want it to. That sort of thing I do pay a lot of attention to.
I would probably flip back and forth between culture and happiness as being the next important, because culture you need to get in the policy tree is to get some nice bonuses. But if you're going on a raffle stump, you kind of need the happiness to absorb all the cities, even if you're just puppeting them.
Well, what throws me off is when you talk about happiness, are you speaking about attaining the happiness resources, or are you speaking about that smiley face icon with a number on it at the top of your screen? Because, you know, as long as that doesn't go into absolutely terrible regions, happiness doesn't matter that much. But extreme resources are god at this game. They are amazing. You can sell them for gold and then translate that into basically anything you want, usually science. So.
Well, both meanings of it there, because you need that to get the gold to get the army up, but then you also don't want to dip below really about 10 unhappy, because that affects your fighting efficiency.
Yeah, in the immediate term, you don't want to be below 10, but at the same time, you don't want to be spending necessarily too long in 1 to 9 unhappiness, because it's slowing your growth.
Yes.
That's true. By the way, I would switch to production as the emphasis if you already have the text you need to win the game, just as a side comment. If you are...
If you work at
things like stealth bombers, or you already have a unit that's probably going to be good enough to conquer everybody, that's probably enough science, and you can start emphasizing hammers a little bit more.
I think it's only fair, similar to when you are writing an essay, for example, and of course I'm using this analogy because I'm a secondary school teacher, that when you're trying to make an argument, that you not only talk about the good points of your side, but you also look at the other side and the other arguments about why people chose something other than science in this list, again, as in a standard game overall focus. NutRM says, production is king early, late, and mid-game. Thing is, production gives you more buildings, and it is buildings that bring you happiness, food, gold, and advanced units. If you start on a production-poor land, you most likely die early. If you start on production, food-rich land, you will most likely steamroll your opponents. Just remember that good land is land that has both production and enough food to sustain it. Actually, to me, if you start on a production-poor land, you are most likely to die early. If I'm production poor, then in that case, okay, I'm actually looking a little bit more at gold, so then I can actually buy production buildings, so then I do have a decent production base to build units. Or if it's earlier game, then forget the production. I'm trying to do an early push, either to take out a sieve or decimate one, you know, take a few cities, but maybe not completely wipe them off the map, to then better position myself to then finish the job. Or Tom McVee says, it's a high production that gets you those science buildings, build wonders, and churn out a badass military. Gold is ultimately an inefficient replacement for production and can't grab wonders. Okay, the wonders thing I get, but ultimately inefficient replacement for production. In Civ 5? What are we saying here? I don't understand.
There are some units that cost more than the hammer to gold ratio would suggest, especially early on. Or maybe it's buildings. I forget which. There are some that you don't get a good deal on purchasing, which you could hammer out, so quote-unquote, more efficiently. But at the same time, gold is a lot more flexible and can be translated into virtually anything, whereas to do that with hammers, you really have a delay on your ability to do that with hammers. You can build a science building or whatever, although that costs you gold anyway, but it takes time, and it takes time for that to pay back your hammer investment. Whereas if you just buy something right away, well, now you have it right away. So I don't know that it's necessarily inferior at all, considering the timetable of it.
With gold, you can field an army, buy city-states, etc. You get access to the rest. While not as immediate or variable as in previous civs, it is still the most versatile. That was Piscop, and then Ruler said later on that definitely gold as the game ends. When you don't have money, then unit production, then happiness, then science. Definitely gold as the game ends when you don't have money. No, see, to me, early to mid-game, certainly early game, would be, you know, other than the overall science focus, it's gold. But then mid-game to later game, I've actually been able to build up my empire through more cities, through larger cities, through, and in turn, being able to work more tiles and having more production buildings that are absolute boosts and percentage boosts. And I'm farther on the technology tree, so now I have access to coal, for example, and I can build factories, and it increases my production. So actually, as the game goes on, I'm looking more at production because I don't have as much. I mean, I do still have gold, and I'm still getting gold, but to insta-buy some later units proportional to what gold you likely have. I mean, I'm not the artificial intelligence, so I don't have typically thousands upon thousands upon thousands of gold sitting around that I could do insta-buy a bunch of units. So it's kind of like, no, it's actually the reverse to me, what you just said there, Ruler.
Your units are on strike.
Well.
But I don't know about the game ends. Maybe that guy's thinking about a negative treasury or something. I don't know.
Oh, would that be a tie-in to another topic coming up on Phil? What are you doing?
It just possibly could be, yes.
Oh, wow. That was amazing. It's almost like you did that on purpose, but...
Almost.
That's giving you too much credit.
Wow.
Wait a minute.
Credit doesn't come to me easily because I'm so good. I have to be spotted a handicap. It's all right. I understand how these things work. But yes... Talk about financial crises for us. Let's hear it.
Segue indeed. Do you think it should be possible to have a negative treasury?
In real life or in game?
In game.
Oh.
In game. Sorry, Mackie, no bailouts here.
Polly does not mean politics, Cast.
Oh.
There is a poll attached to this thread which absolutely had no bearing on it being selected whatsoever.
Right.
Does anybody still believe that?
No.
Okay. We have some new listeners, I'm sure, so maybe they'll believe it. That's for them. Should your treasury be able to go into the negatives? I love how that's phrased, into the negatives. I'm going to use that expression. Anyway, yes 5, no 15, and as an option 3. And I think it's an important question here from Eja Fuss, which was also my first question when I first read it, which is, are we asking about a negative treasury, or are we talking about deficit spending? Because if it's deficit spending, then okay, you're losing X number of gold per turn. That is being deducted from your gold amount, which is still in the positive. But a negative treasury means you are at zero and are zero gold and are continuing to lose money, which if this was Civilization 4, bye-bye units, whereas now in Civilization 5, it's uh-oh, science hit, which, as we discussed in the previous topic, seeing as how science should be your most important focus throughout the entire game, you do not want a science hit, if you can avoid it, at least not for any extended period of time. So the question becomes, should this be possible? And the thing is, well, it is possible to have a negative treasury in the sense that you have zero gold and you're losing money every turn. If we said it wasn't possible, then someone can make the argument, you don't have to worry about managing your economy because you can never have a negative treasury. Okay, you do, but I think the question is, should you be able to have a negative treasury and continue to operate as if you didn't? And to me, the answer is no. And the fact that we get that science hit is a very good incentive to not let that happen. If not at all, there are always circumstances where you could find yourself, oh, I didn't plan it, but need to find a way to actually get out of this extreme fiscal deficit.
It could be okay if, like, maybe we had interest rates or something. And, you know how much people love them in real life, you know? I think it would be pretty amazing if we had that feature in Civ 5. Needed complications to the game.
just picture your typical casual player being like, interest rates? Really? Interest rates? They have interest rates on gold?
And then when you discover paper, gold's worthless.
Man, if I wanted to play reality, I'd just go outside my home. I want to play a game. Come on, what's this?
I don't want to calculate my per-turn rate on this loan I have to China.
Can I refinance? Do I do a reverse mortgage? Can I do a second mortgage?
Can I call for bankruptcy?
What's the keyboard shortcut to call my switch?
I don't trust Firefax's to model this, by the way. I do not.
That would be. Oh, dear.
A government can't even model this. Like, what makes you think Firefax would model this properly? Not to mention, like, this is one of those things, like with the technologies thread earlier. I'm like, okay, yeah, that might provide someone a small advantage. This is one of those things that I can't picture the AI ever being coded to handle it well, like, ever. So it would just handicap it further. And it just opens up abuse, depending on what you allow. For example, if you allow deficit spending, all of a sudden you can get a ton of units for war, start capturing cities and getting your gold back. So you have extra leeway that most civs probably won't utilize in terms of that. And if you can go negative treasury, then you can just go into a huge deficit, not have to worry about units striking, not have to worry about your science rate, etc. It's one of those things, I just see so much potential for abuse and a lot of potential for complexity that people probably wouldn't prefer and not a lot of upside, really. I don't know that it would add, aside from the abuses possible, a whole lot of strategy to the game or a lot of fun to the game. I could be wrong, but this is one of those things where I just don't see it being properly implemented in Civ.
Speaking of properly implemented, a related aside to it, and Lisa brought it up in terms of, you know, borrowing money and interest rates, East Kitten talks about how that he always felt it would be good for gameplay to allow borrowing from neutral parties because it was in Railroad Tycoon, which the original one was a Sid Meier title, but it's not in Civ. But to me, that's getting into an even bigger meta consideration. I mean, being able to borrow from third parties in Railroad Tycoon, okay, you're not controlling the government. There's another political discussion. But anyway, you're not the government like you are in Civ, right? So you could have this theoretical government that's kind of on the meta level that it, quote-unquote, the game, is able to loan you money, and you're paying that back with an interest rate. But in Civ, who is this supposed to be that you're borrowing from? Are you borrowing from the gods or the aliens that helped build the pyramids or something? Like, come on. Like, this is just... No.
Because I can't see you being able to go to another civ and, hey, can you loan me this for this interest rate? I mean, really?
It would be amazing to gouge every other civ in the game, like the Bank of Aztec or something, and just get gobs and gobs of gold through financing.
In a way, you already have that indirectly. Uh-oh, my treasury's going to go in the crapper next turn. Hey, I've got a luxury resource. I wonder if so-and-so would like it for a couple hundred gold. Yes, thanks. Woohoo. There you go. There's your quote-unquote interest. You've given up that luxury resource, even if it's your only one, for the gold. And in this particular case, you're not giving it up so that you can rush by a unit. You're giving it up so that you don't get into a negative treasury situation where then you then get a science hit. Because then that just starts to snowball if that's, you know, turn after turn after turn. Which someone here, Craig123, suggested that it also be tied to low morale for your army, like when you become very unhappy. And I'm thinking, I wouldn't want to have the negative hit to my army immediately, at least as a negative treasure, when I'm already getting the hit to science. Perhaps there could be a situation where if it's X number of turns where you're still at a negative treasury, then perhaps you get additional penalties in addition to the science. But then I start thinking, wait a minute. Isn't science hit in and of itself enough? Because, as I said, if it does go on, it is a snowball effect. I don't really think we need to add more, because you could find yourself in that particular situation. If you start adding penalty upon penalty upon penalty, then if someone really did find themselves in that difficult situation, either they have to go, I need to go back to an old save, or I just need to abandon this game entirely, because I don't reasonably see a way to get out of it.
And right now, if I wanted to sell my only of a resource to get money, I can do that with what's in the game already. Don't need to add it, add interest rates, or what have you.
Borrow it huge amounts of money at a high interest rate, which the AI would allow, and then just declare on them. And if the game cancels your deals, then it would be the exact same as selling gold per turn for gold. And it would work. It would work very well.
Yes, or as Magic said, if you didn't do the declare thing, then research agreement spam, and oh, did we mention research agreement spam?
Yeah, kind of like that whole science is king thing. Yeah, we're not getting away from that.
No.
There's an extra opportunity to get more of it.
The first reply in this thread was from BRX, which was deficit spending would make the game quite interesting. And then Magic Hot Dog changed it to deficit spending would make the game quite silly and unbalanced. I fixed that for you. Agreed.
Yes. Funny, but not necessarily good.
Well, it's funny because it's not actually in the game.
Yes, exactly.
Is there a segue?
No, there isn't. Just start talking.
I love it, though, because Mackie just told me to start talking. So,
about this topic, let me limit you.
Come on, Maggie.
I still win. Yes.
Can talk, just no singing.
All right, I'm going to talk about singing.
No.
So what you want to do?
About talking about late game warfare and air units.
Yes. Two threads to go with this. One is what I consider to be the appetizer, and then the second one is the main course. And this food talk may also tie into another topic later on, but that wouldn't be purposeful either. Corn Oltz, K, said he finally tried Civ 5, and it is quite fun. My problem is that late-game war seems to be dumb when fighting people from other continents. There seems to be no limit to aircraft stacking in cities, and a freaking caravel is hunting and destroying my modern armors one by one just because I find it too tiresome to always manually send them with escorts. How do you invade another continent with cities loaded with aircraft?
First off, why you no naval screen in front of your troops? Durr. We've had to do this in every Civ game ever. Why do you want to stop with Civ 5?
Wow, Lunch Money just said to that part that this is just laziness, but Mackie laid even a bigger smackdown right there, so.
Really? Come on. Naval screen, always. You never know. They could have ships. I mean, it's not as bad as in Civ 4 where they could have an entire fleet parked in one city. But they're still going to have a few naval units out, and you're going to try and sink you when they see you.
What are you talking about? That was awesome. You could sink an entire fleet on this.
Yeah, no, I liked that. I mean, you just in Civ 5, you cannot sail up to the thing and have a whole fleet come out to meet you and destroy all your transports, is where I was going.
That's
but you
true.
Should,
That's
but just
true.
Because there are not stacks of doom does not mean you should not have a naval screen.
Yeah, but even transports would meet caravels handily.
Yeah. Somebody has. Is it Askew whose units can actually defend?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think he's the only one.
Yes, the Songhai.
So unless you're the Songhai, why you no naval screen?
And even then.
Yes. Why you no naval screen?
Late game warfare.
Late game naval units move really far, too. So it's not one of those things where this boat should be sneaking up on you easily. Yeah, I know you have to click a little extra. I'm not a fan of that either, but it's really not that bad, especially compared to a lot of the other grief that Civ 5 gives us. That to, like, create a channel of looking for enemy ships as you transport your units. Gotta open up that hole, get good blocking. It's that good blocking.
It's all about the combined arm. It's all about the support for the actual invasion itself in terms of moving the units across the water. But then it's also about once the units have landed. So you're going after the cities on the coast, for example. You can have, since we're talking late game here especially, you can have the units bombarding either units on the land or at taking down the city strength. And then moving in your ground units the same turn or the turn after what happens to be to capture the city to do with it with what you will. Of course, nuclear weapons comes up frequently in this thread. Like QEC says, I think the nuke option is the best for this problem. And I read that and I thought of Phil.
Yes, well, it is effective, yes.
Super effective.
Let's address the kind of the brief aside with which Gort got to, which was, if you still dislike naval warfare a lot, try playing on a Pangaea map. Or I would extrapolate that to any map that really doesn't have much, if any, of a naval component to it. If you really can't get your head around this or you really don't like it, and, you know, to a certain extent, I can see that. I don't agree with it, but I actually do prefer land-based games in Civ 5. Partially because the game goes faster, but also because I really don't find the AI to be that intelligent on the water.
No, it's...
Maybe I'm just not playing a high enough difficulty level here on Emperor, but I'm really not that scared about the AI doing much of anything on the water. I think of them when I think of unescorted units.
Yeah, let me put this in the one tile hex right next to you because I'm trying to surround your city, but I'm too stupid to realize that putting myself in the water is putting me in danger.
Danger, Will Robinson, danger.
Yeah. How many times have I seen it? Oh, I'm going to switch troops and this one's going to stay in the water. I'm just going to ignore your naval unit sitting nearby that's going to get me. Derp.
And yeah, you know, for a realism argument, it is pretty funny thinking about a freaking caravel sinking a modern armor. I mean, that, come on. That just has to bring a smile to your face, really.
What are they? You transport military.
Seriously, are they wooden rafts?
This is the five spearmen meets tank.
Apparently. And every water.
It's the rust, yeah.
Oh, the bottom rust out, the modern armor falls to the bottom of the ocean?
Yep, that's...
Well, the caravel got Ox updated Minecraft, so it sunk.
How about flinging some freaking bombs?
Yeah, this is what people are basically telling you in the thread, is to bring your own counter-air units. But you have carriers.
Yeah.
Bring a few with you to do the initial screening, and then it's just the air units are the land version of the naval screen. Why do you know air screen?
The second thread gets into the power that is the stealth bomber. Snarsberry used a particular strategy, not just to get to, well, yes, to get the stealth bombers before everybody else, but used a great scientist bulbing capability in order and a research agreement to open up biology to reveal oil, for early electricity to reveal aluminum. And then great scientists plus Oxford and Scientific Revolution, the social policy that gives you two free technologies, to chain bulb all the way to stealth. And because he had access to 7 oil, once he had stealth, he began to build bombers. And then when he got some aluminum, he upgraded them all to stealth bombers. Even though this was a DD game and it didn't initiate conquest until turn 200, there were several massive AI empires of 30-odd cities, and the military rating was off the chart. But the stealth bombers just chewed through everything. And torturous turn times notwithstanding, was surprised with how fast and fun it was. He's at turn 235 with 17 stealth bombers, with 2 tanks and 2 paratroopers that are just zipping and parachuting around the place every other turn, a capping 1 hit point, 100 strength cities. And then he showed us the rage quit screenshot that was Pachacuti. In this game, which looked like all of his cities,
wow.
Plus 455 gold a turn and 22,604 pieces of gold, which guess what he then used to continue to do?
Buy more stealth bombers.
I mean, yes, you've got the production to do that, but hey, let's take 10 turns of peace, and yes, it's resource. It's kind of in that point. It's like, oh man, I'm running out of resources here. Well, perhaps, hey, I could buy another city state, even buy somebody else that has aluminum. Oh, look at all the aluminum I have now, and I still have gold left over that I can buy this stealth bomber and that stealth bomber, or even if he had bombers before that to upgrade them. So he was just able to do some incredible, incredible damage. And that's the thing, if you are able to get yourself in a strong military position, you have strong military strength relative to another civ, and you have done considerable damage, the AI, I mean, understandably, they should be trying to get peace, but, I'm going to mess up this expression, biting your nose off to spite your face, as opposed to the Sith 4 AI, which is, no, we're doing fine on our own. This AI just goes to the complete opposite. You know what? They're just like humans. We do extremes so well.
So basically what he did with the stealth bombers was the extreme version of take things and bombard the city down and just go right in. Do it to their city, has all their in it. Oops, there went your Air Force.
If you're just targeting cities, then you can take the city down and then go after any land-based units in your way, or even do the reverse. You don't even have to take them all out, just enough so that you have a path for one of your units to be able to get in there within a turn or two. And the city's not going to be able to heal fast enough from the bombardment that is sufficient successive stealth bombers. We're talking about 80 ranged attack with a 20 range. And even before that, if you can get yourself to radio and you can get yourself bombers, that's 10 range and 50 ranged attack. So I think, I don't know necessarily to the same extent, but I haven't done this with stealth bombers, but I have done it with bombers where it's great to be able to upgrade your cannon to artillery, but they can be so vulnerable to comparable units in that particular era. Whereas if you've got your stealth bombers, then they're in the city by necessity, and in the city, they're not as vulnerable, and they can attack in the field from afar. Plus, yes, you can restation them, and you can keep adding more and more and more and more to a city. Like used to be in Civ 4 until they changed that, or it limited the number that you could have in the city. I think in Civ 4 it was 4 unless you had an airport, and then it went to 8. As long as you have the resources for it, 10, 15, 20 in a particular city, and they do take some damage, but stealth bombers, being less so than bombers, you can find that, especially if you're able to get there first, you could probably use a bomber, a stealth bomber, half a dozen turns or more before it got to the point where, I think this needs to heal a turn or two, but that's okay, well, this one heals for a turn or two. In those turns that it's been bombing successfully, I've built or bought 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 more, and they can just continue the onslaught. You don't have to stop.
Eventually get air repair anyway, though, and I would imagine fairly quickly.
Yeah, if you're using them that much, they're going to accumulate XP like crazy.
Well, and they're killing things like nobody's business, too. So.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Even if talking about intercontinental invasion, you eventually get that foothold there, and as long as you're able to get foothold between, you know, the siege of your naval units and maybe, you know, land some siege as well, then once you've got that foothold, then start buying, especially in this case, just start buying stealth bombers and, you know, or get the production up in those cities and start building them, and away you go. Ooh, tying.
What, tying to the next topic?
Before we go on to the next topic, there was some related discussion within, in terms of the social policy, because my immediate focus in this thread was, by the way, oh my gosh, he got the stealth bombers, look what he was able to do, look what he was able to do. And then I started thinking a little bit more, okay, cart before the horse, how did they actually get to stealth bombers so quickly and on a fairly high difficulty level, and then being able to use it with such incredible destructive effects against deity AIs? But someone had argued, what if you had gone honor instead of rationalism? Because then, with all those early war successes, you could have been getting gold for each unit you kill, because that's the honor finisher, as opposed to you're talking about the rationalism, which adopting rationalism, first off, gives a boost to research agreements by 50%. So he was doing that, combined with the great scientists, combined with adopting all policies and rationalism, will give you 1+ gold from science buildings. And essentially the comment was, I think you could argue for either or, you know, saying it's a trade-off between earlier upgrades and rush buys and earlier technologies, but he emphasized that getting there sooner meant that he was then able to use them to the effect of getting more gold from conquering the cities and then getting AIs like Patrick Cooney to essentially rage quit and then gave him the gold rather than trying to go about it the other way. And I expect on the higher difficulty level, especially when we talk about how important science is, that is probably the way to go as compared to the other way, and even on any difficulty level, but it's probably exaggerated more on the higher difficulty levels. moving on, we talked about before about how you want to escort your land-based units with some navy so that they don't get sunk, because not only could caravels go after modern armor, they could go after large, life-ending machines.
Is that anything like giant death robots, perhaps?
Oh, maybe. I may have used some synonymous terminology there. I don't know.
Well, over on CSC, Fallen Angel Lord started this topic about how the heck do you stop giant death robots besides other giant death robots and nukes? And hey, going back to stealth bombers, that's one of the recommended things, along with rocket artillery. They were also talking about the nukes, and, you know, this guy was also saying that once you get nuclear fusion, it seems producing any other combat unit outside of nukes is pretty pointless. Phil would probably agree.
I don't know. The stealth bombers are sounding pretty good.
Yeah, actually.
No, I was discussing that tactic with Majin closer to when the threat came out, so I was aware of it, but it's pretty impressive, yes.
You know, I've had so few games which actually got to giant death robots as much as I love them that I don't even...
Have, like, you know, five logistics archers just one shot at it. It's good times.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, the Civilpedia says it is the strongest unit in the game.
Not really.
No.
I mean, technically,
there's a strength rating.
Yeah.
It doesn't make the strongest unit.
On paper.
Yes, on paper, it looks great. In actual practice, not so great. But it's fun when you get into a raffle stump situation just to build it to add insult to injury.
Yes, you need uranium for these. They give their 150 strength, 3 movement. They have a 33% combat odd when attacking cities, but for the most part, who really cares? Especially if you're especially if you have a great general with you, then you can even negate that.
Yeah.
Just like you would with almost any. The thing about no defensive terrain bonuses and can move after attacking. Keep this in mind.
Oh, yeah. You mean the part where you steamroll with, like, one or two of them or something? Is that what you're talking about?
That and being able to attack, and then if they're not successful in their particular action, they've just done the damage, then set it up so that you can actually move after attacking, so you can move them away from perhaps being bombarded by successive units, by a swarm of units, down to nothing.
Yes.
Because the terrain bonuses aren't going to help you, but just like with any particular unit, if you have enough units that are able to one-shot it in a particular turn, poof, the mechanics of the game, it's gone. And you probably would yell pretty loudly if you let that happen to your giant death robot. In fact, I think I hear that right now. I think that just happened to someone in China. Yeah, that sucks. I know, dude. I know.
Someone in China. Oh.
It's pretty hard to move 20 hexes, though, I gotta say.
I had an opportunity there. I should have said that it was actually somewhere in Japan. And then I could have started...
Yes.
You know... Oh, well.
I screwed up that reference, Dan.
And that is where the giant death robots will come from in the future, is Japan. I mean, I think that's...
Most likely.
I guess another unit that you could use back in the reality that is Civ 5 is Rex Mundi also recommended helicopters, specifically the helicopter gunship. You're flying your gunship.
I blame you for this, Phil.
Yes, that is play my fault. You don't say I aim the gun.
Don't play that. You have no idea what that is and be using that. Oh, yeah, the Escapist article, A Gamer in the Kitchen. I was reading this while we were getting set up earlier. This is actually pretty good. I like the analogies he's making about you learn things in the same way and apply them in the same, a similar fashion. It's not exactly the same. But it's also one of those things where practicing certain things gets you better. One quote here he's saying about hardcore gaming involves the same kind of impracticality as hardcore cooking. It's for people who can get really serious about their own enjoyment and are willing to work hard for their fun. Because we've all gotten good and we have fun at these games because we've worked hard at trying to understand them and how they work and taking it apart. That this is part of that thing that separates hardcore gamers and casual gamers. And also the people that only know how to microwave meals to the people that can work in a 4-star restaurant.
I can use a toaster oven.
You need to learn the ways. There are many more tasty things you could be having.
yeah, I enjoy cooking, but there's a lot of things, like, you know, people say if you enjoy cooking or, you know, if you're a chef, you might be, you know, better at chemistry or something, which was not true. You know, like, I mean...
No, chemistry is a horse of an entirely different color. I mean, I know there's some applications now that use chemistry-based stuff to do food things, but it's no.
Yeah, there's a specific term for that, isn't there?
Molecular gastronomy.
There we go.
You just got titrated on.
That sounds appetizing.
Well, that's kind of neat, actually, because this is where you get... Okay, I'm going off topic.
It could be neat without being tasty, so yeah. This article at the Escapist magazine was written by Rob Zachney, who just happened to be a guest on episode 120 last year.
Oh, I thought his name was familiar.
There are a number of interesting points that he made. Well, the overall interesting point, but then the arguments that he used. You know, to cook well, you have to be a bit of a gamer, a person who focuses on getting really, really good at something relatively trivial.
Hey, wait a minute. I'm insulted in two ways now.
Put it.
There's another part where he's talking about the story of this one chef's test for when he was interviewing new chefs coming to the restaurant was to have them fry an egg. And he had a particular way he did it. It was complicated and involved and kind of technical, but it turned out a really, really awesome egg. The first thing most people think of is just heat fat and pan, drop egg in. It's like, no, you're doing it wrong. And we've all had this moment when you try to teach your friends or, you know, people you meet how to play a game better. You want to reach over and click for them. No, do it this way. You idiots.
Yeah, and Rob brings it up in the article that, you know, my identity as a gamer has manifested itself in my kitchen, but with one important twist. The fun I have cooking is the fun I have with other people. But in gaming, my skills are only to myself. I can't game for anyone else.
Well, that's another thing about multiplayers is why we like things to have multiplayer now, because you don't just have fun by yourself. You have fun with a bunch of friends. And sometimes ridiculous crap happens, and that's why we have Turncast.
All game for you guys.
Yeah, run my sieve for me, Phil.
Yeah, and in the multiplayer situation, either it's a competition to see who can raffle stomp who or some other equivalent, or it's cooperative, because you then have that social aspect where it's not just you against the artificial intelligence who, and also he talks about that, as in gaming and cooking, good enough is a meaningless concept because it's unforgivable to ignore an opportunity to make something better. It's kind of almost like in business, you know, I made $100 million last year, but I should have made 110. So it's not good enough to have made $100 million. You have to make that 110. You have to keep pushing and pushing the limit. And because you're pushing the limit, not knowing whether or not you're going to be successful, you actually have it's the fun out of the possibility of failing. Because just like in cooking, let's try this. Oh, either this didn't turn out so well, or it actually turned out to be inedible, but you found out something. You learned something.
Don't do it that way next time.
Yeah, I mean, that's the best lesson learned about what not to do as opposed to what to do.
What happens to this business concept of marginal utility, though? Or am I just raining on parades here?
That's what you're on the show for, Phil, but no, continue. What do you think about?
right. No, I had this strange urge to completely undermine an argument for no good reason, but, you know, it's fun. Get marginal utility out there. Maybe add some interest rates, even though that's a different field.
Interest rates, not those again. Yeah, going back to working hard for your fun, we've all had this. We've had some game that has that boss or that level that's Nintendo hard, but then when you get past it, you know, you want to stand up and do a little dance because you got it. And I've done the same thing after I have to work really hard to make a dish taste good, and then it tastes so good, and I'm like, either what did I do that made this do right? And either way, tasty, I will do the dance when I finish eating.
And, you know, the social aspect as well, when to that effect, and when Rob talked about fun with cooking is cooking with other people, you think about cooking for other people, and you get the enjoyment of cooking for somebody else, because often if you cook for yourself, it's good, but it doesn't taste as good as when somebody else made it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Even somebody who likes to cook a lot, I love it when other people cook, too.
I mean, we all agree that nobody wants to clean up after that. That is a universal given. Okay, just like in gaming. Oh, man. It's like, I tried this, but this failed spectacularly. So, well, how are you going to fix this? Well, in game, you can just restart, but in cooking...
You can also restart. If the pasta's coming out mushy, your sauce is screwed up, you toss it to the bin, you start over.
Especially with Phil's attempt to...
Derail.
Yes, to derail, I copied this out specifically, and this just fits perfectly. There were 28 comments when I checked earlier today the recording to this article, which, by the way, was from 2010, I believe.
Yeah.
One person, Adronicus, has said that, I work in a smorgasbord-type restaurant, and one of the highlights of my time there is discussing various video games with the cook downstairs. Not all the chefs play video games, but the ones who do are quite passionate about them and prove to be very knowledgeable, except for Phil.
Except for some guy named Phil. Oh, dear.
There's some interesting responses in this thread. Those that can really relate.
Oh, yeah, this one guy. I'm going to start it. I'm going to do now. To the kitchen. Comes back 10 minutes later. It's on fire. Start easy, people. Don't try to jump in and make a whole roast beef thing or something.
It's not that hard to cook. It's hard to get a dish just right so that it's really good, but it's not that hard to avoid catastrophic
failure.
Come on.
Exactly. All these people today are going to settle. No, you're not.
No.
Come on. You're gonna, okay.
You might do the steak a little, but if you're watching.
You might burn the toast slightly. Also, don't leave the room when you're cooking.
You can be a good cook. You don't have to cook souffles.
Yeah, exactly.
Someone has said that, you know, I don't cook much myself, but I've always wanted to cook more. This really inspired me, said Snuggle. Someone said that I'd never seen the connections before, but this makes sense. This is from Remote Control Rocks. I often find myself getting frustrated when preparing dinner with my dad when I'm back home. Often enough, I never really get to do very much. It's a bit like he's hogging the game. Let me have a turn.
Damn, it's my turn on the stove. Get out.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
It's kind of like, you know, what women might say. If you don't know how to do it, then we're not going to tell you. So, you know, it's just...
That's hard. You can't be slapped through the internet yet.
Yes.
No. I know I'm in trouble because both women were completely silent, and that is when they strike. Pro tip.
Sneak.
You know, there's a technique to this, Dan. You have to be, like, already starting to run as you finish the statement, so that way you can avoid the incoming blow. There's a timing issue there.
I'm already ahead of you, Phil. No worries.
Okay.
Yeah, he's using you as a meat shield.
Let's not go down this path.
Not that kind.
Come on, Mackie.
As an illogistical kind. Come on.
All right, listeners, thank you for joining us. This has been Polycast episode 139. I'm your esteemed co-host, you love to hate, the me and team, and I am joined by Dan Q.
Don't bomb out. Do be the bomb.
Makalua.
Quit ordering pizza. Learn to make your own. It's tasty, and you can put whatever the hell you want on it.
And finally, Q and L.
I don't know. I'm going to stick with the $5 hot and ready.
Oh. That just sounds wrong.
We know what we're actually talking about, but that's so bad.
Whoa.
I'll show you the hot and ready.
He might be cheaper than $5.
Hey, now.
Oh, at least did you say something about your mom. Whoa, hey.
Zing.
I think you're getting a death glare through the internet right now.
Her resistance has increased.
Oh, they're getting the death glare. Mackie's looking at me.
All like, really?
Anything for attention.
Yes! Nut RM says, production is king, early lame.
Yeah, early lame.
You're lame. No, Phil will be right back after we're from the Disconnect sponsor.
Kate didn't interrupt him when he's on a good thing, but,
I know.
It's kind of understandable.
Yeah.
Understandable? It's not even English.
It's Mackie speak. It doesn't have to be English.
Well, it's English based.
Record date January 28th, 2012. Civilization 4, 5, and World Sound Clips. Copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.